Herzlich willkommen bei Klinisch Relevant, deinem Wissenspartner für das Gesundheitswesen. Dreimal pro Woche, nämlich dienstags, donnerstags und samstags, versorgen wir dich mit unserem Podcast und bringen dir Fachwissen in deine klinische Praxis. Weitere Informationen und Angebote findest du auf unserer Webseite www.klinisch-relevant.de.
Heute hörst du einen Podcast in englischer Sprache mit Laura Reynolds und Dr. Thomas Bünnewig.
Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Klinisch Relevant in English. I'm your host, Laura Reynolds, and today I'm joined by Dr. Thomas Gunevig, Specialist for Neurology, Geriatrics, Psychotherapy, Palliative Care, and Traffic Medicine. He's been the head physician of the Department of Geriatrics and Neurology in Elizabeth Hospital in Recklinghausen for the past 30 years. He's the lead of the geriatrics course provided by the Medical Council of North Rhine-Westphalia. He's the co-editor and author of the textbook Practical Neurogeriatrics, Second Edition. And his hobbies include playing golf, and he is the author of a crime novel set on the golf course in Recklinghausen. Today, we're going to chat about geriatrics, motivation, self-training, and communicating with the elderly population. We also have on Klinisch Relevant podcast episodes in German, and there is a good explanation of the geriatrics department in Germany, so Geriatrische Rehabilitation, from Professor Petra Benzinger. And I think if you haven't listened to that, I think that's a good overview of what is geriatrics here in Germany and what patients are best suited to go to that department. But for today, we're going to hear about Thomas's Erfahrung, his experience. And I'm very excited to have him on with me today. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation.
So yes, I met Thomas at the geriatrics course provided by the Medical Council of North Rhine-Westphalia in the island of Borkum. That's where we met. And I was very interested that on the website of the geriatrics and neurology of the Elizabeth Hospital, he has put together some informational videos and flyers for patients talking about exercise. And I found these really interesting. And I was wondering, Thomas, if you could tell us a bit about these.
So, well, working daily with patients gives the experience that many people are in hospital, and they do a very good training with the physiotherapy. And when they come home, they do nothing. They sit on a couch. And after some weeks, the mobilization is getting bad again. And there is a risk of falls and the risk of traumata. So in the end, we thought about a method to motivate people. That was a reason to do some flyers. So when patients are in our department and we work together with them, they have training, physical exercise, ergotherapy, for instance. We show them trainings they can do by themselves back home. And they have the duty to do training twice or thrice a day for 5 to 10 minutes. And so they have flyers where our doctors on, doctors of our department, and some flyers are done with my picture. So the patients know their doctors and they can do the training back home. For instance, when the family comes to a visit, they don't have to sit down at first and have a coffee and talk. They can sit down and make some training. And after that training, they can enjoy a cup of coffee or a piece of cake or whatever they want to enjoy. So you can include the family in this training. And the purpose is to stay fit, so you can stay in your own apartment, in your own house. And I always say to the patients, as long as you can get up by yourself from the toilet, you can be able to stay in your apartment. But if you need help for the toilet and there isn't anybody, because you're living alone, so the risk you have to move into a nursery home for care is, growing.
I think these flyers and videos are really helpful and very useful, exactly like you said, trying to give something in the hands of the patient that they can physically see and that can motivate them, especially seeing their head doctor or someone that they can identify with and not maybe someone they don't know on a YouTube video or someone who is in a very different age category to them, but they can see that this is their doctor, this is the person who's practicing what he's preaching. And also what you said as well, very important, is if there's a family or carers that are involved that can get involved in this as well and to bring this as in part of their routine and part of their day. Like, they know that if I go and visit my mom today, we're going to do the 5 to 10 minutes. And I think that's also really amazing that that's all it takes. It doesn't take, you know, 3 hours pumping in the gym. It really can be the 5 to 10 minutes doing these exercises, which you've shown in your flyers, in pictures and explanations written about them, what there is to do. And I think that's a really great way to end a stay in the geriatric department.
And it's effective. That's the main point. There was a study in Italy in a nursing home, and the patients living there did training every day. And after a couple of weeks, there were some of them who could train themselves out of the care levels. So that's not the aim to do, because it could be difficult without care level to stay in a nursery home. And the old apartment is given away months ago. But it's effective, so you need muscle strength to avoid falls, and you don't have to need to be speedy and fast, but you need the strength so you can work on it daily. And we motivate people. We even have a video on YouTube with these exercises, and people can watch on TV or PC the video and take part of the training. That's quite funny. And the other thing we did was a video of the neurological body examination. So you can have different videos from 4 to 23 minutes with the whole body examination or parts of it, or just for polyneuropathy, for example, or for the gait balance. And we have altogether 1 million clicks on all those videos. So it's quite interesting for some people in the medical professions or therapeutic professions. And I think there are even some patients watching what the doctors will do to them when they come to the hospital.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice idea, that patients can already see what might happen to them in the hospital so that they're aware, because it can be quite intimidating and scary to come into the hospital. You've got pain or you've got complaints, and then it's not really normal that someone will be examining you and touching your body or your skin. And especially the neurological examination can be quite complex with lots of different instructions. So I think that's really nice that patients can already see that. We're going to link these videos in the show notes as well. And I think if you are in maybe a geriatric department or a neurological department or anything else, you could maybe have a think about, is there a way you could build something like this into your department to make it more personal for your patients? Because at the end of the day, it's about communication and about reaching patients, because we obviously want to prevent them from, if it was a fall that had led them into the hospital, we want to try and prevent that. And the way to do that is through self-training. So we have to think about, how do we motivate the patients the best? And I think that's such a great way to do it, if they see their healthcare team in the advertising campaign and people that they can identify with.
Another argument for watching videos is if patients are in hospital, they have pain or they're disorientated or have other problems and they're excited. And so it's very stressful what we do with these people. And when they're watching a video being at home and feeling quite well, they are more relaxed and they can prepare themselves for situations which might come someday when they have to go to hospital again. So they get to know a face, they get to know the procedure, and they have less anxious moods, so it could be easier for them.
And this leads us on to the what are your videos trying to prevent, especially the more exercise videos and flyers. It's to prevent falls. So do you want to tell us a bit about falls?
Well, there are many reasons for gait disorders in elderly people, like polyneuropathy or traumas in former days, or replacement of knees and hips with ineffective post-op treatment, for example, where there's no rehabilitation. And then there is the lack of training. And when there are many diseases which come together, like diabetic polyneuropathy or multimorbidity with polypharmacy and many drugs who work in the central nervous system, like energetics, for example, or antidepressants, or other mood stabilizers, or drugs for sleep, which old people like very much, you have many reasons that people can have a fall, and many falls lead to fractures, and fractures lead to hospital stay and many times operations, not always, but many times operations. So that's stress for people, that's pain for people, and it's a lot of cost in the medical system. So if people try to stay more healthy and more balanced and have more muscle power, you can avoid spending money on traumatic situations. You can avoid spending money in the health system, which is very expensive in every country of the world. So it's useful to make prophylaxis. But not every fall is reported by patients. When you think about people with a cognitive disadvantage or with a dementia as a problem, they can have a fall and they forget to talk about it. So you see the next day older patients with a cognitive disorder and they have pain. And without a report of fall, you think about arthrosis, arthritis, and you don't think about fractures. And these people can possibly still walk, it's just a new pain. And the advantage is to find minimal fractures or minimal symptomatic fractures. You know why the pain is there. You know you have to treat longer with energetics who are powerful enough to kill the pain. If you have a fracture of your, how you call it, Becken in English? Your pelvis, right. So if you have a fracture in pelvis, they're almost never operated, but you need painkillers to do that. And you have to inform people and their family why they need to take painkillers for 4 or 6 weeks. So you need a clear diagnosis. So when people with a cognitive disorder tell you about pain, always think about a trauma which is perhaps not reported. So in this case, it's just make more X-ray diagnosis. And the normal X-rays might pass a fracture, so you can use a CT or MRI to be sure that there is no hip fracture, because as more you intensify your diagnostics, you less will oversee a fracture of the hip, for example.
That's a really important point, especially in geriatrics, that, yeah, people have dementia or they might have a delirium and might not be able to report their fall. And that I think also we have to think about getting a third party history, so that if somebody maybe witnessed the fall that the patient can't tell you about, but maybe they can clarify that. So if there's a family member, or if the person is coming from the nursing home, maybe they'll be able to tell you about that the person had a fall. So it's worth getting in touch.
We take as often as possible the collateral history, especially in cases with a cognitive disorder, or in cases with a mood disorder, or in cases with a deficiency in in hygienic circumstances, living alone at home. So you need to know, you need to have information about the kind of living, like, is the food okay? Is the handling with the heater okay? Do they close their doors? Do they drive the car, able to drive it with sorgfältig, how you call that? That they have no risky behavior while driving a car. So we talk to family, and more often than not, we get useful information. So we can prepare for the discharge situation just quite early in the treatment. And we need to know which kind of social support people need when they go home to their own apartment, or if the discussion about returning back home is, well, useless and you need to take care with a nursery home placement, for example.
Do you think that communication with elderly patients is different, and how would you say it's different?
At first, you have to take care that people can see you and can hear you. So they need their spectacles. You have to clean the spectacles. You have to put the hearing aid inside. Many old people have a hearing aid, but it's in the sideboard and it's not in the ear. And sometimes it's in the ear, but there is no battery working in it. So you have to take care that people can hear you. And you have to check it out. So you talk and you ask, did you understand me? What did I tell you? And the next thing, you need to have a symmetric communication. So if you stand in front of people and they sit or lie in front of you in their bed, that's not symmetric. That's people look up to you, they listen to you, they don't try to speak out. So in the end, you have to sit down, you have to have eye contact, you have to speak slowly enough, and you have to avoid doctor speech, as I call it. No Latin words, you need to use simple words what older people can understand. That's the main topic in conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a really important one. And I think we might take it for granted that some elderly people have really poor vision or really poor hearing, but they're able to kind of get through life, or they're so used to it that they'll just nod along or they'll smile and they'll say yes, but they don't really hear you or see you. And I think that's very important to be aware of that. And especially even if you're seeing your patients every day for 2 weeks, I think it's always a nice idea to still introduce yourself to them every day and explain why you're there. Like, I'm the doctor, I'm here on my ward round to see you. I think because it can be very confusing in the hospital. There's a lot of people coming in and out of the room, especially in geriatrics. You have the nursing staff, you have the physiotherapist, the occupational therapist, the psychologist, the speech and language therapist, the ladies or men going in with the food every day. And I think at some point we all sort of look the same. We might even wear similar uniforms depending. So I think that's an important point that you've brought up, to just remember that and think about it. Like, can your patients see you and hear you? And are you at an eye level with them to make them feel comfortable to talk to you?
Yeah, and you have to check out if people understand you, if they understand what you're talking about. So sometimes I ask them, what did I tell you? What do you think about it? And when they are able to give with their own words the issue back to the doctor, you know that you are understood. So that's very important. And sometimes, even especially with people with cognitive failures, I check out if they are orientated. Sometimes, many people think everybody knows how old someone is and everybody knows which month it is. But when you ask, how old are you? They're 81, they tell you 74. You know there's a problem. And if there was no problem before a traumatic situation or an operation, you think about a delirium. And if you talk to the family and you get hints about cognitive disorder in the last 6 months, you have to think about dementia as a problem. So you check people out if they are orientated, and you ask them, and you if you ask friendly, nobody is, what do you call this? Nobody is offended, yeah, right? So communication is very important for people and patients, and especially what are the needs of patients? What do they want? They don't want always the same thing, what the doctor thinks. They have their own expectations and their own wishes. So one thing in communication is to ask them what you want to reach coming to hospital. What is your main topic? Do you want to walk again, or do you want to have less pain, or what is your issue? And sometimes it's very easy and very simple, but sometimes it's astonishing what people tell you. And then you can make a pact or a contract about what you want to reach together. That's one point of work you can think about.
On the topic of communication with elderly patients, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the families. I suppose how I think about it sometimes, geriatrics or just working with older patients, is it's in some ways the opposite of pediatrics, in that the doctors are treating the children, but they also have to treat the entire family unit. So the parents of that child, or if that child has siblings. And I feel like geriatrics is the opposite. So we're treating these older people, but they also oftentimes will have adult children. And I find this dynamic a very interesting one, because on the one hand, these children are adults, but in this dynamic, they're always the child. And trying to navigate this can sometimes be a bit difficult. Or I just think it is important to try and navigate it and bring the families along, obviously with the consent of the patient, obviously.
Yeah, you have to have the consent, that is true. That's the basic, but it's always useful to put the family in, because you need to know if the family support is there or not, and then you need to know if it's sufficient or not. And there are the caregivers in the family who are very much stressed, who are overperforming, who are getting tired, who don't get enough sleep, who have their own diseases with pain, for example. They don't care enough about their own sicknesses. So it's very good to know these people in the family, husbands or wives or partners. And then you can talk with the family and the patient all together, and you know about the needs for the family, for the caregiver, and the needs for the patient itself. And sometimes there are astonishing relations and astonishing expectations of patients and of caregivers. And you have to try to match it somehow. And if you see it doesn't match, you have to think of another system of giving care. So put in professionals, for example.
That brings us to, what are the aims in geriatrics, or how do you counsel patients maybe, or give them a prognosis if, you know, their expectations are different to what your expectations of them are, or maybe the family have different expectations, and how do you navigate this?
Well, at first you should know the expectation of the patients, then the expectations of the family. And if there is a gap, you have to talk with them all together. And you should know what is a realistic aim that people can reach in Unabhängigkeit, on dependency, on what can they reach in self-care management, where do they need support, and then you have to think about how can you realize it with a nursing visit in their own apartment once a day, twice a day, or is there more support needed? Like you have 24-hour caregivers, if there is enough space in an apartment and if there is enough money which could be spent to pay these caregivers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, you have to talk about it. Sometimes patients say, I don't want to have people in my apartment which I don't know. Family is okay, but no strangers in my apartment. Then you have to think, is it realistic that the caregiving twice a day is enough for these patients, or do they need a nursery home placement, for example? And you have to talk about these alternatives with the patient and with the family. And then the patients have to decide, or the caregiver has to decide when the patient is not more cannot decide anymore, because if he's, for example, has a dementia. So the other thing is, sometimes you have possibilities of treatment with medicaments or with operations or other invasive therapies like CT-guided injections, for example. But in some cases, people don't like invasive procedures. So they say, okay, doctor, very nice that you think about possibilities, but that's not my way of treatment. And they endure their symptoms like pain or immobility. And when people decide this way and they are mental healthy, you just have respect these restrictions people give you. Then you have to be a counselor how people can live with these restrictions in daily life in their apartments, or they can't live anymore in their apartments. So I give my advice and leave this family with the advice, and they have to discuss with themselves how does the life will go on when they leave the hospital treatment. So in the end, it's my advice is one main point of the treatment quality, I think. It's not always medications and it's not always operation. Sometimes it's counseling of possibilities. And people are free to decide against the doctor's advice. That's okay, as far as they are. We call it geschäftsfähig in German. How do you call this in English?
Yeah, they're capable. They have capacity. They're able to make decisions. I'm wondering, because you mentioned about it, you know, when it comes down to it, you might have to discuss, is it appropriate to discharge a patient back home? Do you have to maybe discuss discharging them to a nursing home if their needs are increased? It's not seldom that we come across patients who perhaps were able to live at home alone. Maybe they had nurses coming in twice a day, but something has happened. And let's use the example of a fall. They've come to hospital, they've had their operation. That might be enough in and of itself, but on top of that, they might have potentially all the possible complications that you can get. So they get a pneumonia, a urinary tract infection. They might get atrial fibrillation. You know, there can be all these things that might come on top. And sometimes they just, in the time in hospital, they just don't make it back to that baseline that enables them to go home. And that can be very upsetting, I think, for the patients themselves and also their families. Do you have any advice about how do you deal with that disappointment? For example, some patients, they'll say to you, I want to walk again. And you see them walking with their wheelie walker. And in my eyes, that means you're walking. But for them, it that's still not walking, because before they had the fall, they were walking without any aids at all. So no wheelie walker, no walking stick. They were able to do everything. So they see that even though it's so much better than just lying in a bed, they still see it as a failure. And maybe the family also expected more. Do you have any way to deal with this?
I think it's very important to give patients a name and an opportunity to hope for. So I can't versprechen, was heißt versprechen? I can't promise them healthiness, and I can't promise them you will definitely with 100% walk without a wheelie walker. But I can tell them if you try and if you train, the chance to walk better and to possibly get rid of the wheelie walker is much better. So it depends on you as a patient and not only on me as a doctor. So, and if they take responsibility, it's their own job to do and to work and to do. But if it's if it's not very probable to reach freedom walking without a walking aid, without a wheelie walker or a stick, I tell my people, so you're walking again with a wheelie walker, so use it. If you don't use it, you might fall. If you fall, you have a fracture. If you have another fracture, you need an operation. And you're 89 years old, so the risk for delirium is there, and the risk for staying immobile, even if you have an operation. So think about it. What is your preference? Walk with a wheelie walker or walk and fall without a wheelie walker? So people have to decide for themselves. Only if people have a cognitive disorder, then you have sometimes decide for the patients. So you include the family and the caregivers and the heuristic caregivers for patients. Then you have to decide together with them what is the best for the patient itself if the patient can't decide for him itself.
Yeah, it goes back to the motivation, isn't it? Which then leads back to, for example, your videos and flyers and helping people to want to help themselves and take, as you said, responsibility and motivation to help themselves to stay mobile, to build the muscle to keep them strong enough to stay mobile.
I have a good clinical example. We have an 87-year-old man with a lot of overweight, 126 kilograms. He was in the cardiologic ward with a heart insufficiency. After that, he wasn't walking anymore and standing anymore. He was lying in bed for 10 days, starting home and then at the cardiologic ward. They gave him diuretics. He was losing body weight and the legs were getting smaller. He had 105 kilograms in the end, and we started walking with him. So in the end, he could walk on the wheelie walker, but he was not self-sufficient for bathroom and stuff. So he went to a short-term nursery station. And there he was, after 6 days, he was walking alone, quite happy. And he left back home alone, which was a little bit early. And then he had much weight put on these on his hands. And he got he drank some beer, and he got a Gicht attack, a hypouricemia. And he had pain in his hand, and he was lying 2 days in bed, and he came back to us, and he wasn't able anymore to stand up alone from sitting or from lying in bed. So we start once again. He was very fast going back in the training in lack of training. So we train with him again, and hopefully he's coming home again when the pain and the arthritis is getting better with cortisone therapy, and when the training once again is working well for him. We will see. But every step back because of diseases, it's getting more difficult to make him movable again.
I see it. I counsel, when I counsel families, because to try and, I think, communicate to these adult children that their mom or dad is maybe going downhill, I try and use that maybe as an example. How many times have they been in hospital over the past number of years than how many in this past year? And it's then more objective that the time between admissions is getting smaller, and their overall illnesses are increasing. It is the way.
It's the way, and it's especially difficult when the children are living quite a distance away, with 200-400 kilometers distance. So they are coming to the parents in hospital when something has happened. Then you have to discuss once again the situation, and you have to try to make the best of it. What is the prognosis? What is realistic? And what is your advice for the patient? So in the end, you have a chain of events, and one day you just need a decision what you do, or what you change in your daily preparation, or what you change in your daily living care and support of the patient. And sometimes you need one step back again, that people are can possibly decide to say, I don't go back home, I have to take more care support every day, and I go to a nursery home. And the way is sometimes very straight, and sometimes it's very curvy.
Yeah. I feel like we have covered a lot here. Is there anything, final messages you'd like to discuss that I haven't asked?
I would say the communication with patients, and to know the wishes and the aims of patients, is very individual. So talk with the people is always surprising, or sometimes very surprising. And it's more as you know your people, your patients, as more you can think into their mood and into their wishes, and you can try to make it realistic. But sometimes you're failing, and then you have to have other proposals what people can do and patients can do. So it's a very creative art of medicine.
I think, communication was a very big topic here. We said the importance of checking that the patients can hear you, see you, that they are cognitively well enough to understand you. And in terms of other forms of communication, in this example, the flyers and videos which you created to try and reach patients and motivate them to do some self-training to prevent falls and to stay living mobile, because ultimately that is the hope for all of us. we're hopefully all going to get old, and we want to get old as healthy as possible. So yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you very much for coming on and having a chat with me.
Yeah, it's very nice talking to you. Thank you very much for your invitation. And I hope you will carry on your podcast in English with German doctors, even if they miss sometimes the right words to tell on the micro.
Not at all. I really appreciate it, because I know it is nerve-wracking. I think pretty much all of my guests are nervous to come on, and I do appreciate people coming out of their comfort zone to chat to me. And it's something I enjoy. I get very nervous too, I have to say. So I think it's nice to do something that scares you and to talk about topics. And I hope that these podcasts are useful for people, that they find something that they can take with them in their daily practice. So thank you for agreeing to come on.
Thank you very much too.
Vielen Dank, dass du heute wieder zugehört hast und unser Gast gewesen bist. Wir hoffen sehr, dass dir dieser Beitrag gefallen hat und du etwas für deinen klinischen Alltag mitnehmen konntest. Wenn dem so sein sollte, dann freuen wir uns sehr über eine positive Bewertung bei Apple Podcasts. Falls du Lust hast mitzumachen und es einen Themenbereich gibt, in dem du dich besonders gut auskennst, dann melde dich doch gerne unter kontakt@klinisch-relevant.de. Gleiches gilt, wenn du Themenvorschläge oder konstruktive Kritik für uns hast. An dieser Stelle auch der Hinweis auf unseren Newsletter, den du unter www.klinisch-relevant.de abonnieren kannst und der dich immer auf dem Laufenden hält. Wenn du dich für unseren Newsletter einträgst, bekommst du einen 5-Euro-Gutschein, mit dem du in unserer Fortbildungsakademie einkaufen kannst. Wir wünschen dir jetzt bis zum nächsten Mal eine gute Zeit und freuen uns, wenn du bald wieder einschaltest. Pass auf dich auf, bleib gesund, bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.